You are listening to the Ivy Podcast. Learn from the thought leaders in areas of strategy, innovation, negotiation, and all things leadership. We interview the Ivy League, Fortune 100, and top startups. Now, here's your host, John Karsibayev.
On this episode, I host Manish Sinha, who is a global CTO at L'Oreal. Manish has more than 25 years of experience in IT and related services industry. Before L'Oreal, Manish has worked at Ansys, UBS, Yahoo, and Microsoft Corporation. Manish has won the 2016 CIO of the Year Award by Pittsburgh Technology Council. He was nominated for the Wall Street Journal CIO Forum. PwC recognized Manish for his work in information security. He also won the Worldwide Leadership Award for Privacy by Microsoft Corporation. Silicon India magazine profiled him as the Executive of the Month. Please welcome Manish Sinha.
Hi, my name is Manish Sinha. I'm the corporate CTO in L'Oreal, located in France.
Manish, thank you so much for finding time to be with us today. You're based out of Paris, and you know we have a pretty significant time difference. I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you today. Can you tell us a little bit more about L'Oreal from a technology standpoint? We all know it as a cosmetic company, but I'm curious to hear a little bit more from technology standpoint and what falls under your purview as, you know, as the lead of the technology division of that organization.
So John, let me start with telling you a little bit about myself, and I'll talk about my current role in a few minutes. So I started my career working for platform companies, Oracle, Microsoft, Yahoo, shipping technology, in the good old days when it was a shrink wrap product. I changed focus and went on the other side to see how consumers were consuming these products. And that's when I went to companies like UBS and Ansys. And now I'm with L'Oreal, still with IT, enabling the infrastructure of 85,000 employees globally who are using technology for all kinds of purposes, everything from communication to line of business applications to back-end applications. Specifically, my role is to manage the infrastructure in L'Oreal for all corporate functions, which are managed out from France, which is the reason I'm located here.
That's great. Thank you, Manish, for sharing that. For a global brand in personal care, what does digital transformation mean for the organization or your from the past experiences that you've been engaged with other organizations? And how does that translate to the overall kind of employee and user experience?
Yeah, it's interesting you asked that question. There's not much difference from one company to another or one area to another, especially when it gets to digital transformation. You know, Satya Nadella said some weeks ago, somewhere I was reading, he said in the last 3 months, we've made 3 years worth of digital transformation. What does that mean, right? So I look at digital transformation with three different aspects. The first, of course, is are there technologies available? Are there technologies which are being deployed? And we can talk about an example after I'm done. The first one is, of course, are there technologies available? The second, like you rightfully said, what impact is it happening, having on the employee experience and on the user experience? Internal and external. But there is a third aspect which often gets missed, and that is what is the mindset of those employees or the end users. So now let me take the example and show what that means, right? So let's just take the Microsoft example, Microsoft Teams or Slack or Zoom, communication technologies. I'm not going to argue which is better, which is worse. They're all communication technologies, right? All have been around for a few years, but their deployments happened in the last 3 months has been much greater than the last 3 years, is what Satya says when he says digital transformation. Why is that? It's not because in the last 3 months we shipped better products. It's not because the employee experience changed. It's not because the end user experience changed. It's because the mindset changed. The mindset was, now I have to stay at home, but I still have to communicate. How do I do that? It's no longer possible for me to host a meeting with, you know, 10 people who are all on the same building or the same floor. They're all on different houses. That mindset has changed. I need to go buy products. I need to no longer go to the store. I need this product to come to my house. So e-commerce became enabled, right? So for digital transformation, all three have to be present. Good technologies, which change the end user experience and employee experience, but also their mindset of those end users or employees have to change. And that is usually what takes time. And that is what has accelerated over the last 3 months to give us 3 years of digital transformation in the last 3 months.
That's interesting. And thank you for categorizing that into three different aspects of that. I couldn't agree more with you. I spend a lot of time interviewing different executives of various organizations, and that topic is, you know, definitely always comes up. And one recurring theme that you also touched upon is really any digital transformation usually starts, you know, or you should start with people transformation. It's at the end of the day that people have to be bought into the vision. It's almost, you know, it's almost cultural transformation for any organization. So that's very interesting. And, you know, thank you for sharing those examples. I want to switch topics a little bit and talk about innovation, because it's something that I'm very interested in, especially during current times. You know, innovation for a lot of organizations and even individuals is not necessarily at, you know, at the top of your mind. If we look at, you know, like Maslow's hierarchy of needs, you know, current times really almost all about the bottom level. It's you're mostly concerned about safety and you know, things like that. So when it comes to innovation, especially during these times, from your perspective, what strategies and methodologies do you deploy that consistently help you come up with innovative ways to solve certain problems for your products, your services, or your, even your internal teams and people and so forth? I'm curious to hear your take on that.
Yeah, so, you know, there's the basic necessities, right? Is, you know, the people have to be there, the right people who can, who are smart enough to innovate, all that. I'm sure a lot of people have talked about, right? Which is all true, which is all required. There's a saying which says, necessity is the mother of invention, right? So if there is a need, the invention will happen if you have the right people and the right environment. And as an executive, as a leader whose team needs to innovate, my job is to create that necessity. So the necessity could be created by either, you know, raising the KPI bars, the SLAs, raising the goals, or creating or reducing the amount of money for doing the same amount of work. You know, there are many ways you can create that need. At the end of the day, that is what is important, is create the need. Some people will say, oh, create the urgency, right? And in fact, in the hard times we are going through, a lot of people have said, you know, don't let a crisis go on the sideways, right? A crisis has happened. We didn't create this. It has happened. Let's use it to innovate. In regular times, how do you create those mini crises, the needs, so that necessity can be the mother of invention? That really is what leaders do to motivate the right people at the right environment, and the rest the people will do.
Mm-hmm. Right, absolutely. I love that quote, you know, necessity is the mother of invention, and you're absolutely right about that. You know, in the current times, especially, like you said, it's not something that we could have planned for. It's something that we've created. It came out of nowhere. And that really, that necessity really also, you know, almost kind of one of the critical pillars for that further innovation, invention. How do we adapt? How do we, you know, evolve, in these current times? So that leads to a lot of new ways of doing things, new products and so forth. So that's very interesting. I want to talk a little bit about some advanced technology such as, you know, RPA, artificial intelligence, machine learning. which are, at the end of the day, they're reinventing the software engineering and information technology as a whole. How do you think these trends will impact your industry from innovation standpoint? And what are your thoughts on best strategies to adopt such technologies, mainly because it's such a sexy term that everybody's talking about, but when it comes to actual practical implementation and usage of such technologies, it's a completely different story.
Yeah. So, you know, like you said, these are advanced and new technologies, right? But the business problem they are solving, they're not new. They're not advanced. They've been around for a very long time, right? So let's take an example, and I'll tell you how. Let's just take the support industry. 20, 30, 40 years ago, 30 years ago, technical support by Microsoft and Oracle and all these big name brand companies was done from the US, from London, from, you know, very, very expensive countries, right? Till somebody realized we can move this off to cheaper countries, started the migration of these to India into 1999, 2000s, 2001, offshoring was big, you know, that was a big trend. Then technology advanced further and we said, why do we even need humans to do it? You know, some portion of it can be done by chatbots. And now chatbots became real. And, you know, today, I don't know, 20, 30% of the time you do technical support, there's probably a chatbot on the other end solving your problem, right? Tomorrow, these chatbots will become artificially intelligent and they will be solving many more problems and they will be machine learning capable. So they will teach themselves and they will solve even more problems, right? My point to the story is the technical support industry has not changed at all. It is a simple business. Customers have a problem. Technology providers will solve those problems and customers will be happy. Right, the story has changed from high cost to offshoring to machine learning to chatbot to machine learning to artificial intelligence. So the point I'm making is each wave happened when the quality on the other side was so good that it made absolutely no sense for us to spend more money when it could be done at a cheaper rate or a better price. When I went to India with Microsoft, the support industry was, the technology was great, you know, calls could be routed around the world, people could be trained in India, we could hire 50, 60, 70 people in a week, which was unheard of in the US. And it was so good that it made no sense to do support in the US. Mm-hmm. Now, it had its bumps on the road. The same thing when chatbot came, today 20, 30% of the chatbots are solving, 20, 30 of the problems are solved by chatbots because chatbots are now so good, they cannot do 100%, but they could do to 20-30. Is AI at that stage where it can be solving the next 20% without causing customer pain? And if the answer to that question is yes, it makes no sense for us to deploy human beings or chatbots who are not AI capable and machine learning capable. So people who are producing these technologies, RPA, AI, and ML, should be focused not on, you know, how this deployment will happen, but on is the quality as good as the alternative or better? And if the answer is definitely yes, leaders like me, executives like me will deploy these technologies, right? Like I said, you know, necessity, right? I mean, the necessity is there.
Right.
The invention is coming. Mm-hmm. And with each advancement, more and more technology will get deployed.
Absolutely. And like you said, you know, these concepts, these methodologies, they've been existing for a very long time. It's just different trends, I guess, surface these days that, you know, make these sound really cool. And at the end of the day, I love what you've mentioned in terms of really first understanding what is the true business need for such technologies and understanding how can that particular technology help you solve a particular business problem. So that's really at the core of, you know, really first understanding not how to implement this, but why are you actually doing this? So that's a
I think that's exactly what I'm saying, right? Is what is the business problem?
Yeah.
What portion of that business problem is not being done efficiently today?
Yeah.
Which technology can help me make it much more efficient and with a certain level of quality, which I'm not ready to compromise.
Right. Absolutely. Right. Makes perfect sense. I want to talk a little bit more about, you know, a topic that's very, you know, very interesting to me, because mainly at ProSource, we specialize in that field. We partner with companies to help them find a very niche advanced technology type of, you know, candidates and skill set that are in high demand. And when, from your standpoint, when hiring for your teams and the candidates that interview with you, obviously they go through many rounds before you interview with them. I'm curious, do you get creative with your interviews, or, you know, you keep them pretty traditional? But more importantly, I would like to know what exactly do you look for in some of the responses when you interview your candidates?
So once again, you know, let's step back and look at what's happening in the industry, mm-hmm. right? Then we can talk about, and hence, here's what I'm going to hire. Right? It's a business problem and then the solution, right? So here's what is happening in the industry. There are two sets of expertise which are developing. One which I call deep expertise, and the other one is broad expertise. This is not to say one is better than the other. It's just two different skill sets are required, right? Mm-hmm. Deep expertise is people who can write machine learning algorithms, or they can, you know, pull apart attributes and make the machine learn. They understand everything there is to understand about AI. They can write development code. That's deep expertise. Broad expertise is people who understand the business problem, people who can coordinate different steps of the action, and people who can string these different actions together to solve the business problem, right? What is happening in the industry is the deep expertise is actually more becoming outsourced, the gig economy, because I need that skill set for a short duration, you know, maybe a month, maybe 2 months, maybe 6 months, I don't know. You know, in long projects, it could be a year, right? But I don't need it for the next 5, 7, 10 years. Mm-hmm. And let those expertise be brought in at a particular time, solve the problem, and they are going to go to another company and a third company and a fourth company. And over a period of time, they're going to become much more valuable because they will have learned, they will have developed different ways. So if I hire AI and ML in a company and keep them for a long time, they are going to know only what is in my industry to learn from that portion of the technology. So more and more companies are going towards hiring broad skill sets, and the deeper skill sets are becoming gig economy. They are, you know, look at whose number you look at, McKinsey's number or whatever, you will see big number of people who are leaving corporate jobs to become, you know, self-employed, because they are deep in expertise. So having given that background, when we are hiring for those internal skill set, which I'm going to use for the next 4, 5, 10 years. And I'm going to hire those broader skill sets, people who understand a little bit about the business, but they can string together project management. They have to become creative. They have to learn different things. So it's interesting. My way of interviewing is I don't interview. I let the candidates interview me. And I let them interview me on a particular topic, which they don't know. Or they do have, you know, very high level knowledge of. Mm-hmm. And what I'm gauging is how fast can they learn? Because that's really what I want to hire for. People who can learn fast and, you know, apply those skills. What is state of the art today will be obsolete in 2 years, 3 years.
Right.
Right. So my people have to continuously keep learning and enhance their skill set. So that's what I'm learning for. Oh, that's what I'm hiring for. Uh-huh. Right? So most often, I mean, you know, of course, my team will have interviewed them and they will have selected one or two. But what I'm looking for is always, can they learn fast?
Right.
If I'm hiring for an external hire who will come in for 6 months on a project or 1 year for a project, of course, then I'm looking for deep knowledge. Mm-hmm. I don't want them to come in and learn, right? They have to bring in a lot of skill set and deliver in 6 months or a year, and then they're done, off to another company, another project.
Right.
So completely different skill sets for whether I'm hiring for internal or external.
That's a great, you know, analysis in terms of the type of profile of a candidate that you target when it comes to the broad expertise and the deeper expertise that you talk about when it comes to, you know, someone for a long term and someone for a shorter project. So that's a very interesting concept. And also, I like what you said for a candidate to interview me. A lot of times at the end of the day for the interview, it's a two-way street. It's not only for the hiring organization to interview the candidate, but it's also for a candidate to interview the, you know, the organization and see if they feel right about this, if they feel comfortable with the type of leadership that's leading the organization or the type of culture that's being represented. So I think that's very important. And I love, you know, the fact that you mentioned that you really allow for a candidate to interview me as a leader for that organization. I think that's a, you know, one of the key attributes of great leadership to me if I was interviewing within, you know, that organization. So that's great. Do take that subject a little bit further. When it comes to attracting the top talent to your teams, obviously as an executive, that's probably a 24/7 job. And I don't think that ever ends. You're always on the hunt for, you know, the best people. It's something that, you know, it's always there. You meet people on a daily basis. You work with different partners and vendors and so forth, and really, you know, evaluating the different type of caliber of people. I'm curious, what strategies do you deploy, if anything, you have specific that helps you attract, you know, the top talent, top caliber people for your team?
So, you know, different companies I've worked for have gone out to colleges and hired either interns or, you know, brought in fresh talent, right? I actually love bringing fresh talent on. And it's because, A, they bring so much energy and innovation. You know, they want to change the world. They have the drive to do certain things. Nothing is wrong. Nothing is right. It's always, you know, let me go experiment, right? That's what we want to bring in, right? The energy level. And then the second thing is they also can be molded and brought into and given the culture which the company has. So it's a two-way street, like you said, again, right? We are bringing a culture of high energy, high talent, real smart people. So wherever we can promote ourselves to bring in those kind of talent which are coming in from good schools, good colleges, engineering or MBAs, or, you know, that's where we attract a lot of our people from. Mm-hmm. Of course, there are always people who will be brought in with experience. But I think the larger numbers come in always from, you know, fresh talent.
I love that example, because it's funny that, you know, just yesterday I was interviewed by Forbes, and one of the questions that came up was really specific on that particular subject, to talk about like a case study where we helped an organization to build and lead a high performing team. And really the case study that I presented there was when we've partnered with one healthcare organization that really needed a small team of, you know, highly skilled, you know, in very specific area, which were very difficult to find. But at the same time, organization was trying to build very fast-paced, dynamic, almost startup-like culture where experimentation and innovation was at the core of everything. So what we found through that process is that we were interviewing a lot of, you know, very experienced experts in certain areas, like you said, you know, deep expertise. But they had, you know, 15, 20 years of experience in that particular area, but they were not necessarily the right personality or the fit for that type of culture they were building. So conversely, we partnered with the leadership of that organization and said, why don't we take a different approach and invest more into that training and onboarding collateral, and instead target the young and hungry, the recent grads, the people who will go above and beyond to learn something, you know, even on their own, where they don't have to, you know, almost use their own ways of doing things. They will get creative. And that really was a very, you know, very successful case study, which actually the organization, very large healthcare organization, they've adopted that model throughout their organization in terms of other divisions. So that's a perfect example kind of.
Yeah, it's actually both, John, right? I mean, I think of teams as let's think about them as chariots, right? And you can replace chariot with any mode of transport, and I think you will get the same thing, right? But chariot actually brings the image to life. So a chariot usually has 4 or 6 horses and is managed or, you know, is given by a human being who has reins. Mm-hmm. And I think the teams work the same way, right? So the horsepower is given in teams by these fresh graduates, the fresh people, the younger team members who are low on experience, but very high on energy and intelligence and, you know, creativity and the willingness to go change the world and, you know, break things will eventually lead to create things.
Right.
That's what they bring. And I compare them to the horses of the chariots, right? But then you need somebody who is managing the reins. So there is some level of, you know, we are going in one direction.
For sure. Somebody to steer them, yeah.
Somebody to steer them. Definitely. And those are where the people with experience come in.
Right.
So you try to replace the newcomers with experienced people or the experienced people with newcomers, and the chariot is going to go haywire.
Absolutely.
Right. You can apply the same thing to, you know, my son used to do dragon boat racing in Singapore.
Oh, wow.
Right. And they would take all these 16-year-olds, 17-year-olds to do the rowing. Uh-huh. And there would be one experienced person who would be drawing the drums, right? Mm-hmm. Same analogy.
Right.
It's exactly the same way teams have to be built.
Absolutely. I love that analogy. I mean, at the end of the day, you need somebody to steer them. You need somebody to lead them. So that type of leadership. And at the same time, you need the horsepower. You need somebody to actually, you know, come up with ways and execute. So that's great. Manish, last but not least, I'm curious, what are you currently reading? And what is one book that you always recommend to others and why?
It really depends upon who I'm going to recommend to, right? So there's not one book I can say, you know, everybody can read and gain from.
Uh-huh.
The book which I'm reading right now is, it is actually a coach's playbook. So I'm learning to coach others to be high performing. Or I'm improving my skills to become a better coach, if you will, because that's where I play, right? I don't do many things. I coach others to do many things.
Right.
Right. And so the book which I'm reading is A Coach's Playbook. This is the stakeholder-centered coaching by a gentleman called Marshall Goldsmith.
Mm-hmm.
This is the person who wrote... What got you here will not get you there or won't get you there, which was a bestseller for, I don't know, the better part of a decade. And that book still is on the top 10 reads, you know, at least for me. This is what I would recommend to people who are going to coach others and mentor others, you know, the people who are going to run the reins of the chariot, if you will.
Uh-huh.
Right. If you're talking about people who are, you know, on the other end of the spectrum, there are probably other books.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what I'm reading. Your question was, what am I reading? That's what I'm reading. And that's what I would recommend to anybody who wants to be a leader.
That's great. Thank you for sharing that. I'm definitely going to look into that. And for our listeners, we'll make the title and the author of that book available in the episode notes. Manish, I know you're a very busy guy, and I can't thank you enough on behalf of all of our listeners for sharing your expertise. You know, through a very short conversation, I learned quite a bit myself. I'm pretty sure that our listeners will do as well. So we thank you for your time, and I look forward to, you know, us catching up in a couple of years and see how much I've changed, see what are the different other new things that you can share with us. So I'm definitely looking forward to that. And thanks so much, Manish.
All right, look forward to it 2 years from now. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to the Ivy Podcast. Be sure to subscribe to our RSS feed on ivypodcast.com and all major podcasting platforms like Spotify and iTunes. As always, if you enjoyed this podcast, please give us a rating on iTunes.